Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, Richard Curtis, the man behind blockbuster movies including Notting Hill and Four Weddings and co-founder of the charity Comic Relief, will be chatting to me about this coming Friday's RTE Does Comic Relief. Also today, the brilliant writer Bernardine Evaristo on winning the Booker Prize and this week being the first black person to top the UK book charts. I'll talk to the two winners of the brand new Dorky Literary Prize and we'll have some great music from Owen Blacken. Our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rte.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, first up this morning, one of our most popular summer events, the Dorky Book Festival, established, of course, by Shan Smith and her husband, David McWilliams. But like so many other festivals, it's had to be cancelled because of COVID. But this festival decided to continue with its plans to inaugurate its own literary awards. And last night, they were announced online. And I'm delighted to say that its two winners, Christine Dwyer Hickey, who won Novel of the Year for The Narrowland, and in the Emerging Writer category, Sinead Leeson won for Constellations. They both join me now. Morning, Christine and Sinead, and congratulations.
Oh, thanks very much, Miriam. Thank you.
Thank you, Miriam.
I'll start with you.
Congratulations, Sinead.
I'll start with you, Christine. Novel of the Year, 20,000 prize as well, sponsored by Zurich Insurance. You must be delighted.
I'm delighted of myself, but I feel a bit greedy as well because I had two prizes in 1 week. So it became a bit of a shock. One day after another, I found out. I'm really thrilled. It was lovely, especially being the inaugural Dorky Prize. It's fabulous. And fair play to them, I think, for going ahead with them. Nobody would have said thought any the worse of them if they had put it on the long finger or postponed it. You know, we have to remember all the hard work that goes into organising literary festivals around the country. And we do it so well in Ireland. And then to have to just stop it because of COVID.
Yeah,
you know?
It's hard.
But it is hard on them. It is very hard on Shan Smith, especially for in this case. So anyway.
No, brilliant. And Sinead, in your case, 10,000 euro as well as winning. So were you delighted?
I was, as anybody who saw that myself and Christine were interviewed, and we thought we were being interviewed in general with the rest of the shortlist, so we didn't know that we'd won. So I think both our faces are quite priceless. You can watch it on the Book Festival website. But I completely agree with Christine. I mean, literary festivals are such a lifeblood for writers in Ireland in terms of like events and book sales and meeting your readers. And Dorky is one of the, I think, one of the best and one of the biggest. And as Christine said, they could have decided, okay, we'll save it, we'll hold on until next year because there won't be the events. But for me personally, I think, and it's the same for Christine, a lot of writers, a lot of people in the arts, you know, performers, theatre makers, artists are all really suffering the last few months with everything that's gone on with COVID. And so to win a prize is a lovely thing. The fact that there's money attached for me actually means an awful lot at the moment in terms of being able to write more and not having to work as much. And I'm so grateful to Shan and David for all that they do and for going ahead with these prizes. I'm just thrilled.
Yeah, absolutely. And Christine, in your case, I mean, in a short while, I'm actually going to be speaking to Bernardine Evaristo, and she won the Booker. I mean, winning prizes, they do matter, don't they, Christine?
They do, I think. I mean, it's fabulous when you win, but there's an awful lot of people writing out there, Miriam, at the moment. There's so many, and I think there's so many really good books too. There isn't room for everybody that just get overlooked or something happens that they don't make a list. So it's important that writers realise this, and I think we do, that it doesn't mean just because your book isn't on a particular list that it hasn't worked. But when you're on the list, it's great. You know, it is fantastic. And when you win, it's even better. And as Sinead says, the few bob is no harm either. But I am really delighted. I am really delighted. But I'm well used to not being on lists at the same time, you know. I am used to that too. I expect to be disappointed before anything else, you know. And I'd forgotten about the Walter Scott one in particular because I just presumed they had postponed it. I knew the docu one was coming up, but like Sinead, I thought I was just being interviewed for, you know, a general one for all shortlisted people.
And it is lovely to watch that. Yeah. People should watch on the website. No, because you both are so clearly surprised. And Sinead also, you're both, you know, women writers. You've been a great champion as well, Sinead, of other women writers. Do you think this will encourage more and more women to write?
Yeah, I do. And I, and the fact that the category that I won in is emerging writer. And I think we live in a world where youth and newness and being very young is prized ridiculously so sometimes. Over half the people on the emerging writer list were over 40, as I am myself. And I think that a lot of people, because of time or money or caring for parents or children, it's not feasible to write a book in your 20s and your 30s. And there is no time limit on becoming a writer. And that's what I loved about it, the fact that the prize recognised that you can be emerging in your 40s and your 50s. And I think that's really important to sort of reinforce that, because some people think, okay, I'm 40, it's too late now. It really isn't. And that's, I think that was a really special element to this year's prize.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, Bernardine is 62, you know, and that's when she, just shortly before this, won the Booker Prize. So you can win at any stage, really, Christine, can't you?
You can. You can keep at it. So that's the thing. We can't retire, really. We don't retire after our hands fall off. And even then, I think even like a writer like Henry James used to dictate because he could no longer use his hands. He had a condition. But, you just keep doing it. As long as the head is okay and the hands are okay, you can keep at it. There are times when you feel like stopping, of course, but throwing in the towel, but you keep going, you know. And, Miriam, could I just say something about these other shortlisted people?
Yes.
Because I know you're going to ask us about books, but I'm so excited about everything that's been going on, I'm afraid I'd forget. That I only managed to read two on the shortlist already, but they're fantastic reads. Jan Carson's book is wonderful. A great look at the through orange-tinted glasses at the situation of the North. It's very funny and very quirky. And Joseph O'Connor's book is really, really quite marvellous. Most people know that, I think. But anyway, I just wanted to mention them in case we slip onto something else.
Yeah, and Sinead, likewise, you probably want to mention the other books.
Yeah, I mean, I think that and a prize like this, an emerging writer category, because you can put fiction and non-fiction, and there's a wonderful Eleanor Fitzsimons wrote an incredible biography of E. Nesbitt, who wrote The Railway Children, and her book is just fantastic and beautiful. But I think what always happens around prizes is that people always look at the shortlist, and anything that gets everybody talking about the six books or the eight books or how many are on a shortlist, it encourages readers to go into bookshops and go, I heard about this book. And it might be the one that won. It must be like, it might just be something you saw on the shortlist that intrigues you. So book prizes are essential for that reason. They get people interested in books, they get people walking into bookshops to buy books, and it starts a conversation. And anything that gets people reading, in my view, is always a really good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then it probably also encourages people to go out and buy your books. In a short paragraph, tell me, Christine, for our listeners, what your book that's won, Narrowland, is about.
Well, it's about a lot of things, but mainly, I suppose, it's about a marriage. It's the story of a marriage. It also is a story of trying to recover from war and the idea of forgiveness. Like one of the main characters in it is a little German refugee boy. How you come back from that. If you are German and you carry that, you'll always carry that weight on your shoulder, the guilt of the Second World War. And it's kind of about all that sort of stuff in America and how it kind of looks back on how America today started to develop around or to evolve around the 1950s, I think.
Okay.
So, you know, different people see different things in it.
And
I'm the worst one to ask.
Yeah, no. And Sinead, Constellations for our listeners?
Well, it's a book of essays about a lot of things, and some of it is about parts of my life, but it's a lot. I talk about bodies and illness because I've had some very difficult experiences with those things. So I talk about hospitals and doctors and the medical world, but I also talk about motherhood and politics. I talk about artists and music, which is a big part of my life. I talk about my great-grandmother and my grandmother who grew up in tenements in Dublin and had a very different, less privileged life than me. But all the pieces, I mean, like the book is called Constellations because they're all distinct pieces, but I see that they all kind of overlap and are one big piece read together. There's a couple of pieces in it that I never read at festivals because they make people cry. So and me included, I couldn't get up and read them. But so there's a lot of different things in it. And the essay is a form kind of lay to jump around on different subjects. And I had loads of things I was interested in writing about. So this kind of suited it.
Well, look, congratulations to both of you. For you, Sinead, for Constellations, you, Christine, for The Narrowland, and for all those who were on the shortlist as well. As you say, they were all wonderful books. And
they
well
are,
done
yeah.
to Shan and David for doing it in the Dorky Festival. Thank you both and congratulations. Enjoy your day today.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you, Miriam. Thank you, Christine.
Bye.
Enjoy.
Thanks. Bye. You too, Sinead. Bye.
Delighted. Now we're going to have some music. Well, Ed Sheeran's a fan, so is Damien Dempsey and Joan Armour Trading. And now Owen Blacken, whose music is described as alt country, has released a new song, which is very appropriate for the time we've spent in lockdown. And Owen joins me now on the line. Good morning, Owen.
Hi, Miriam. How are you?
Grand. How are you doing?
Not bad at all now. Glad to be seeing a bit of normality coming back to the world, you know yourself.
Absolutely. Tell me about this song. It's called Before the Rain.
Yeah, well, it's the new single, as you said. It's just an imagining, just walking through a world on the brink of change and just taking in the sights, you know. It's one of those.
Yeah, no, but you've spent the last few years, I actually met you at Glasgow Airport a short time ago, but you've been opening for people like Joan Armour Trading and Aslan. Has that been very important for you in developing your career?
Oh, absolutely. And funny you mentioned Aslan. I was just thinking that earlier on. I remember I was sitting in the airport in Dublin on the way to Glasgow, and you came over and sat down beside me in the cafe, and I remember kind of thinking, there's really no Callan. And I said hello to you, and you were very nice and friendly and gracious, and we had a little chat. And then a couple of minutes later, all of Aslan, who were on the same flight as me, arrived around the corner. Yeah. And we're like, all right, Owen, how's it going, Owen? And I remember just being so happy that you were there to see it. If you know what I mean? I was like, if it's going to happen, you kind of hope someone's there to see it. You know,
yeah.
But they're the kind of things that make your day. But
And it's a great opening for people like Aslan and Joan Armour Trading.
Absolutely. I mean, getting in front of people, you know, other people's crowds is just, you know, always a great opportunity, you know yourself. Aslan have been so good to me over the last couple of years, and they've been really important gigs for me, I think, because they've sort of, I've been doing them solo on my own, you know, and I've kind of started to hone this sort of a one-man band sound off the back of doing those gigs, and it's actually become something I've started to record with and write with in mind, and it's become quite an important thing, and it all happened off the back of doing those gigs going around Ireland with Aslan and over to England, so it's been very important, and they have the best audience, you know yourself, most enthusiastic music-loving audience, and they're always so receptive, so it's been amazing.
And you are a one-man band setup. You play the drums, you play the guitar, you sing, you do everything yourself at the same time. You're going to do a Facebook Live gig, I think, this coming Thursday at 8. Is that right, Owen?
Yeah, Owen Blacken Music on Facebook. I'll be doing a little gig. So if anyone's around, please drop in.
Well, we're going to listen now, Owen. Thanks for joining us to your new EP, Before the Rain. And it's available, of course, for download now from everyone listening. Thanks so much. Mind yourself, Owen.
Thank you, Miriam. Good luck.
Take care.
The dark clouds came forward in their heavy hordes. Hearts were spinning wild like weather vanes. One old nun I saw, are you at peace with all you've done? Said I'm just trying to make home before the rain. A voice on the news said we're closing down the schools. Some shrugged it off as fake, some went insane. Some looked out of space and cried, we really should have tried to find another home before the rain. Before the rain. Puritan, tell me friend now what was there to gain, and the prison grounds were bare, from the gallows to the chair, chains are the last thing to break before the rain, before the rain. And It was the nails they wanted. As crucifixion's gone mainstream again, and the political elite set all their files to delete. Who knows what's gonna float before the rain? Before the rain. Just trying to make it home before the rain.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number is 51551. You can email miriam at rte.ie and you can find us on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, Bernardine Evaristo's novel Girl, Woman, Other not only won the Booker Prize earlier this year, but it's also currently the number one book in the United Kingdom. It's the first time any black writer has been number one in the UK, and it's very close to the top here, only beaten by the juggernaut that is Sally Rooney. The novel is the fascinating and beautifully written stories of 12 women of different ages and backgrounds as they navigate modern life. It's been called dazzling, funny, magnificent by readers and critics. Earlier this week, Bernardine and her fellow writers from the Black Writers Guild called for sweeping changes in publishing, calling out inequalities within the business. And I'm delighted to say that Bernardine Evaristo joins me now on the line. Good morning, Bernardine.
Good morning. Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, look, it's not lost on anyone that this recent invigoration and pushes for change of all areas of life, includes the publishing industry, is because of the death of George Floyd. Do you think that real and permanent change might happen now?
I've got more hope at the moment because it's very interesting because the Black Lives Matter movement has taken off in such a big way at the moment since, obviously, that tragic death. And so many organisations and institutions are looking at their own practices and doing a lot of self-interrogation and becoming aware of the ways in which they have discriminated against people of colour. But I think it's more hopeful because we've never had this in the past. We've never had it taken on in such a way by so many of our organisations and also the media.
Which is great. Well, look, let's talk about your Booker-winning Girl, Woman, Other. It's a wonderful book. For people who haven't read it yet, tell them what it's about.
So it's a novel about 12 primarily black British women, their age 19 to 93. The youngest is a university student. The oldest is a farmer who lives in the north of England. And their women are a variety of ages. So they're every generation in between 19 and 93. And they come from different cultural backgrounds. They have different sexualities. They're different classes. They have different occupations, different preoccupations, and different family setups. And they are interconnected with each other. And each woman has her own section, but it is a complete novel. And as you read the book, you encounter each woman in turn, but you also encounter them first in other character stories. So I call it a fusion fiction because I've invented this kind of quite unusual style, I guess.
Who's the other in the book?
The other is whatever people want it to be, really. So I think women are often othered in our society. Mm. We're often marginalised, regardless of race or sexuality. I think black women are othered. I think black people are othered. I think queer people are othered, working class people are othered. I have a non-binary character who is othered because of that. So, and sometimes the novel is, the women are really diverse in the sense that they're not all in agreement with each other in any way. So I also have them othering each other. So while some of the women are on the queer spectrum, some of the women are arguably homophobic. So other is kind of all-encompassing, really.
There's such a scope of the stories, too. I mean, all the women, I think, are British with different heritages, ranging from Nigerian to Ethiopian to Caribbean. I mean, are you telling stories in a way of what it means to be British?
I, I think so, you know, because I think the British narrative is much broader than we've been led to believe. And so, you know, all those people who are othered are often left out of the mainstream narrative, which is often very male, and it's very white, and it's very heterosexual. So when I positioned that number of black women, primarily black women characters, and a load of others as well who come into the story, but they're not like the leading characters, they're not protagonists, then I think I am making a sort of statement about Britain, that these women are important. They're worthy of fictional representation, and also that they are as important as any other group in this society. Because what happens is, if you are marginalized in some way, then you are also invalidated. You're treated as if you're not as important as some others, so other people. So that's what I wanted to say. And then, you know, people are describing it as a novel about England. Well, it is not Britain. Well, it is a novel about Britain. As much as, say, an Ian McEwan novel, it might be a novel about Britain. Or Martin Amis, or, you know, so, yeah.
What's your own heritage? I think you're English, Nigerian, and do you have a grandmother from Burr in County Offaly?
Yeah, great-grandmother.
Oh, great.
So my heritage is, my father came from Nigeria. I have a Brazilian Portuguese surname. So my father came from Nigeria, but his father came from Brazil to Nigeria. And he was part of the movement of freed slaves and other Africans who sailed from Brazil to West Africa after slavery had ended. And in Brazil, that wasn't until 1888. So my father's father actually died in 1927. And then on my mother's side, and my father came to the UK in 1949. My mother grew up in London, and her mother grew up in London. Now, her mother was half Irish. So my great-grandmother came from Burr, and Mary Jane, and came to London in about, I think about 1875, I might have got that wrong, and spent the rest of her life in London. She came to London when she was about 12. And then on my mother's side, her father's grandfather was German, and he came to London in the 1860s from Germany. So that's the heritage that I have.
Fascinating. You're such a mixed heritage. It's great. You also, you cover such serious subjects in the book. Look, coercive control, secrets, parental abandonment. And yet there's a lot of humour. I mean, do you think it's really important to have that balance of light and shade? I mean, do you want to entertain?
You know, I do. I do. And if I write and there is no humour in it, somehow the work has no life. So I have this propensity to inject humour into my work. And it's not as if I think this is going to be a funny book, because that is not how I approach my work. I just think I'm going to tell this story, and then the story unravels as I start writing it. But what happens is the humour is always there. And it's always a mixture of both. You know, there is humour and there's lightness, but there's also seriousness, because I don't want to, you know, not go into all those dark aspects of life. But I just love playing with humour. And I do it differently in different books. In one of my books, Blonde Roots, it was a satire, you know, out-and-out satire. Whereas with this book, I think, and it's very hard for me to analyse my own humour in my books, but I think it's the humour of just being human, the humour of people having a very kind of quite noble idea about themselves, but other people having different opinions of them. Because the book is, even though the characters present themselves in a sense in their own chapters, we see every character through multiple other characters. And they often are contradicting how the character sees themselves. And I think that lends itself to humour. Because I think, in a sense, we're all unreliable narrators. We can't really see what other people see about ourselves. And we're all flawed, you know.
Yeah.
We can be hypocrites. We're contradictory. We can be very self-serving. And I think all of those things are rich for humour.
You have said, Brendan, that when you began writing it in 2013, it was the type of book nobody was looking for. I mean, what changed, do you think, since 2013? And then winning the Booker Prize and it being exactly the type of book people must be looking for.
I know, yeah. So you're right, there were two changes. The first was that when I started it in 2013, you know, there wasn't much interested in black culture or black women's writing, for sure. You know, there are very few of us even today. But two things happened. Black Lives Matter, the first time round, and the Me Too movement. And that, and also I would throw social media into the mix, and suddenly feminism was on the agenda, racism and anti-racism was on the agenda, and then you had a whole generation of people coming up through social media who had their own platforms and were able to develop their own communities and be extremely vocal, as they are, on social media. So suddenly that was shifting the perspective of the society. And then winning the Booker was just, you know, first of all, the first black woman to win it, the first black British person to win it. And then it's just been absolutely seismic in terms of how it shifted my career. And suddenly the people who might not be interested in reading my work because they think, oh, it's about black women, that's not about me, I'm not interested in that, they are reading it because the Booker has so much kudos, if you like. So they are reading it, and then they're seeing the humanity in the stories. And that's what I love about it, that these women, and I do think this is quite a radical book in a sense, in terms of its form, because it is, you know, experimental. And in terms of all these different women and all the things that I'm exploring about their lives, but it's still reaching, as far as I know, and the responses I'm getting, it's reaching the reader, the kind of reader who wouldn't normally have picked this book up. And they are picking it up, and they're finding, you know, finding the riches in it that they need to find. And I find that incredibly reassuring and gratifying.
Yeah, they absolutely are. You shared the prize, of course, with Margaret Atwood. Yes, there's that gorgeous photo of the two of you walking arm in arm. What was it like, actually, you know, to be acknowledged as just as good as someone like Margaret Atwood?
Yeah. Oh, it's, you know, I don't think I'll ever get over it because, as I said, I've been in this game 40 years, right? Mm. So she wrote The Handmaid's Tale probably when I was in my 20s. So Margaret Atwood has been a total legend for the whole of my adult life. And then to as you say, pick up the award with her, and she was just amazing. And we got on really well, and she was just fantastic. And she's a fantastic woman, fantastic feminist, fantastic writer. So to be up there with her was just the most incredible experience. And I think even though there was controversy over it, you know, still today, you know, you shouldn't have given it to two people, I don't object to that at all. I think it's so hard to get the Booker, so I could take it any way it comes. And also, I think it's also kind of a bit more egalitarian. Mm. Why not give it to two people? Why not, you know, honour two people in this way? So, Yeah, mind-blowing is the only way I can express it. And I'm still kind of pinching myself, to be honest.
One thing you've also spoken about, Bernadine, is about the importance of a positive mindset and the use of affirmations, which you use to achieve this. How does this work? Explain this to me.
Yes, I've been talking about this quite a lot, actually, because I used to talk about it, you know, sort of on a sort of micro scale, and people would look at me as if I'm mad. But now I say, you know, I visualized winning the Booker over 20 years ago, and they're like, what, really? Yes. So, I used to do these personal development courses, and I used to learn how to be positive, because we don't have a natural inclination to be positive in this country. People do in America. You know, one of the great things about America is that people have a really positive outlook in so many ways, whereas here we don't. And I had to learn how to be positive and also how to be ambitious. I was ambitious, but how to be even more ambitious and how to set goals, how to think big, how to think, at, you know, when I published my second book, how to visualize winning the Booker, even though it was a million miles away from me until I actually won it. It was a million miles away from me. But to visualize it and somehow believe it might happen, but not to get hung up on it. And to think about my wheel of life, I used to do this course called Mindstore, and he has this drawing that you do, and it's called your wheel of life. And you look at all the different areas of your life, and you try and get that wheel in balance. And it will be finance, it will be career, it will be relationships, health, home, family. And you try and get it so that it's all equal, rather than your career is brilliant, but your family is absolute, you know, in the doldrums. So those were the kinds of things that I was learning to do, to write affirmations, to talk myself into thinking positive and being positive, to draw creative visualizations, so to materialize visually the things that I wanted out of life.
That's so interesting. I mean, do you think that it's often said, Bernadine, that women, and I suppose including in that, and maybe more so black women, are afraid to be too ambitious? And I mean, are these affirmations a way also of trying to counteract the force of patriarchy and remind everyone that you are good enough?
Yes,
Absolutely, absolutely. So even at a very basic level, it might be looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, I am fantastic, I am a brilliant person, and I'm going to be the best person I can be today. You know, just saying that to yourself is one step towards counteracting everything that you described. Still coming up against these brick walls and these, you know, the institutional biases towards men and cultural biases towards men, and also just amongst ourselves, not validating or valuing ourselves as much as we need to, or each other, women to women, as much as we need to. So I think it's so important that each person takes responsibility for self-empowerment and to be powerful in this world and to change the world for the better.
I love that idea of you, that you visualized yourself winning the Booker Prize.
Yeah.
It's great. It
worked. I never told anyone. All these years, I never told anyone. And I have like a sort of almost like a big box of all my affirmations upstairs. And I started to go through them and I was like, oh my God, I got that. It was, you know, the relationship, you know, I'm married, I have a husband. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't have a husband or the kind of relationship that I wanted. And so I used to visualize, you know, bringing somebody into my life who would be right for me. And I did find that eventually 15 years ago.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
Because often people don't even really think about what they want for their lives as well. People just go along. You know, you might think, oh, well, I do want a relationship. You might think, I want marriage. I want children. I want a good job. But a lot of people aren't thinking much beyond that. It's like when you really interrogate your life and think about the things that you want and the things that you want for the people around you, then, and for your society and your community, because I'm an activist as well, then it's really powerful to think, well, okay, I'm going to think about this and I'm going to decide what it is I want and I'm going to visualize it and I'm going to believe that one day it's going to happen, even though everything is telling me it's never going to happen. It's like Obama. You know, I'm a huge fan of the Obamas. You know, a friend of mine used to know him, and she brought me his book, Dreams from My Father, about two or three years before he became president. And she said to me, she put it in front of me, she said, he's going to be the next president of America. And I was like, you're right. You know, and I did not believe it until he actually was voted in. And then I was like, oh, my God, he did it. But I didn't believe it. And I'm a positive thinker. But he believed it, right?
Absolutely. So, I think a lot of people listening this morning, Bernie, will be, you know, affected by what you're saying, people who want to change their lives or do things. You're also the professor of creative writing at Brunel University in London. I mean, for anyone listening, for instance, who really wants to write and hasn't yet managed to write that book, what would you say to them? What's the affirmation?
Yeah. An affirmation needs to be personal, positive and passionate. So, for example, if you want to write the book, it would be something like, I am so happy that my book has been published. No, I am so happy that my book is published. And present tense, right? Present tense. Not that it's going to be, but that it is. That's the kind of affirmation I would write in a card. But then you can't just write an affirmation and put it in a drawer and it's like, well, that's it then. It's going to happen. You know, you literally have to then do the hard work. And as a writer, you know, this may sound intimidating, but it builds up over years. It is thousands of hours of doing the job, of doing the work, believing in yourself enough to do the job, and then getting the support that you need to get feedback, because we need feedback. And it's about reading. And it's about reading widely so that you become a better writer through the books that you're reading, and then slowly building up your skills and maybe doing courses or degrees if you need to. And it starts with that first word on a page, on a screen, and then you build it up from there. And, you know, the journey of a thousand miles begins with the first step. Well, it's the same with writing. You know, the journey towards publishing a book begins with the first sentence, and then the next sentence, and then the next sentence.
As we come to the end of our interview, I mentioned at the beginning the letter from the Black Writers Guild, which, of course, you're part of. Do you think you winning the Booker Prize will make literary agents, publishers sign up more writers from BAME backgrounds?
Yes, I think so. You know, that's the real joy, I think, about winning the Booker. It's like it shows that the kind of book I've written, which is not what you'd call a commercial book, is very literary and it's very kind of all about these outsiders and so on. I think it shows that this kind of book can do really well because through winning the Booker, it has, as you said earlier, become a bestseller. Mm-hmm. And the Black Lives Matter movement means that a lot of the books by Black writers, and some of them are Black British writers, have also stormed the charts, right? Storm the charts, which is, and they haven't been on the charts. Maybe they were never on the charts when the books were first published. So the whole thing is saying to publishers, you know, there is aesthetic, creative value to our work. There is cultural value to our work. But most importantly, there is also economic value to our work. And so when you see the sales of these books, including mine, then how can you not sign up writers from those communities who you've kind of pretty much ignored up to now?
Your book, Girl, Woman, Other. It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. I've loved speaking to you. Very inspirational. And lots of luck for the future. And it's published by Hamish Hamilton. Thanks so much.
Yes. Thanks very much.
Mind yourself. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, this coming Friday night, June the 26th, RTE Television will be clearing the normal schedule for a whole evening of Comic Relief. RTE Does Comic Relief will be hosted by Deirdre O'Kane, Nicky Byrne, Jennifer Zamparelli, Owen McDermott and Baz Ashmawi. And it's going to feature the very best of Irish talent. Everyone from Chris O'Dowd to Aisling Bea, Hosier, Jason Byrne, Christy Moore, Dara O'Brien and many, many more. Well, over in the UK, Comic Relief has been raising money through the BBC for local and overseas charities since 1985. And with Comic Relief now in America, the charity has raised more than £1 billion. It was, of course, co-founded by Richard Curtis, screenwriter, producer, director, the man responsible for such adored films as Love Actually, Notting Hill, Mr. Bean, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Bridget Jones, and so many more. And Richard Curtis joins me now from his home in London. Good morning, Richard.
That's a very, very comprehensive introduction. Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Listen, to remind my listeners, Richard, would you go back to 1985 when you and the great Lenny Henry co-founded Comic Relief and why you did so?
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is that it was almost a mistake. I offered a friend of mine to go with them to the Sudan because there was a famine going on there. Mm. I didn't have a plan and I went there and saw, you know, such terrible things. So when I came back, I thought, well, surely comedians can do their bits just like musicians have done for on Live Aid. And we did a stage show, which is what you used to do in those days, like actually my friends Darren and Dee have been doing in Ireland over the last few years. And then we thought, well, look, we're all TV people. Why don't we do a big old TV show? And so we started doing it. And unfortunately, it's been extremely successful, so we've had to go on doing it.
Did you ever think it would be as successful and as enduring? And why do you think it has been so successful?
Well, no. I mean, I think, you know, the real reason for all this stuff, you know, for the success of anything is the generosity of the public. I'm such a optimist in terms of human character, and I just think if you open a door so that people can do the right thing, then they pour through it. And so what happens is we just give an opportunity. What's so wonderful about this show on Friday is it just gives an opportunity to people who've been worrying, what can I do for my neighbors, what can I do for people whose lives have got really tough? You know, suddenly you just give them an opportunity, a really easy and then entertaining opportunity to reach out and help other people. So the reason for its success, I think, has been that we've kept up some good entertainment, but that also people are yearning for a way to help, you know, the lives of people whose lives are hard.
How do you make sure, Richard, that all the money raised, like £1 billion, it's an incredible amount of money, goes to the right people? How do you make sure of that?
Well, you have to introduce systems that are as rigorous as you possibly can, you know, on the ground. So, in other words, you know, we have very trusted partners. We have extremely trusted employees. They're overseen by extremely trusted committees who look at everything. So, you know, you can find the best. The best partners. You've got the Community Foundation Ireland there. They work every single day of every year making sure that the money does go to the right places, that they check it up and all that. So I think what you do is you work with the best people. So it's certainly not me and Lenny, and it's certainly not going to be, as it were, Pat Short and Dermot Bannon deciding where the cash goes to.
I saw actually a lovely clip about this coming Friday that Emma Freud, your partner, who's also the exec producer of Comic Relief, of course, in the UK, where you have seen a sketch involving the two stars of Normal People, the blockbuster hit, of course, and you love it, don't you?
Oh, I was furious. It's so much better than anything we've ever made. I mean, I can't even say all about it because there's a guest star in it.
Yes.
But it's really beautiful. I mean, one of the things about Comic Relief is it just gives opportunities for things to happen that would never happen. I can't imagine any context in which they would have allowed a sort of little extra special into the world of Normal People. And you guys have got two. There's a beautiful piece called Normal Older People, which is imagining what would have happened to Marianne Connell, you know, 40 years from now. I promise you, though, these are two very special bits.
Yeah.
I've just got sent the rundown by Dee of everything that's going to be happening on the night. I was just thinking, what's it like? And I think it's like a fridge in a hotel where you open it up and you see all these perfect little miniatures. And you think, oh, well, I'll have all of them during the course of the night, because there are so many great bits. You know, there's, I think, Zig and Zag are returning, and you've got Normal People, and you've got, you know, Dancing with the Stars, and you've got Pat Short and his daughter doing great stuff. And you've got a beautiful thing by Christy Moore, and you've got The Den, and you've got this guy, Dermot Bannon, who I believe is an enormously important cultural figure.
He is.
For whom they've written an opera. So it does seem to me anyone watching it is just going to have a really great time. And then right in the middle of all that, you know, really touching appeals that'll just show how you can get to people who've been so hard hit by the coronavirus crisis.
And of course, the D you're talking about there is our great Deirdre O'Kane. Yes. Where did you get the instinct, Richard? I mean, to do so much charity. Did I read correctly that your mum once cancelled Christmas and gave the money you would have spent that year as a family on Christmas at the time of the famine in Biafra? Is that correct?
That is true, yeah. And it was baked beans on toast for Christmas lunch. And I remember we were taken aback and shocked. But the great thing was we used to hate Christmas lunch because it came at the same time as Christmas Top of the Pops. So we'd be eating turkey when we wanted to be watching Sweet. Actually, we had rather a good year. Also, you know, I was raised in the Philippines for 3 years. So I think I did become very aware of the contrast between rich and poor. And the thing about this is the more you do it, the more you realize how helpful you can be. So like in this crisis, you suddenly see the problems with mental health, the problems with homelessness, the problems with domestic violence. And once you've started sort of looking into it and looking into how much you can help, it does become, you know, very addictive, because you suddenly realize it isn't the power of all of us with just a small donation to possibly radically change someone's life. And you know, that's actually more fun than writing another line for Hugh Grant to spoil.
Our listeners, though, are still loving your films. You managed to have married both, though. I know you're focusing more on the charity side of your work, but is it a nice feeling that so many people still love your films and take a lot from it and are made happy by it a lot of the time?
Yeah, you know, it really is. There's a hilarious podcast that's just started called 2 Minutes About Time. And what it does is it's an hour-long talking for about 2 minutes of the film About Time that I wrote. And the idea that there's anyone who could be that interested in anything I've written is both bizarre and delightful. And they have become a kind of comfort food. I'm aware of that. And I also do think that the world is full of wonderful things. You know, there are people falling in love every day. There are people who are exceptionally kind. There are people who are exceptionally funny. So I'm glad if I can, you know, in dark times particularly, pump up that view of the world a bit.
Have you always had a positive disposition? Like, have you always been a glass half full person?
Yeah, I think so. But I think you should also, you know, I also think I've had a very happy time. You know, I've been very lucky with my family, with, as it were, both my families. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes find it a bit perverse that people who you know have had good lives then write films about serial killers. I think, well, why? You've had no experience of that. So I think in some ways it's my duty as a person who's been so, you know, lucky with my friends and lucky with the people who've loved me to, you know, reflect that in the things that I do rather than, as it were, just be as sarcastic as I can be.
We've obviously got two people who've done an awful lot in terms also, because I know you're the founder of Make Poverty History, Bono and Bob Geldof. Isn't there a great story that Bob told you, Richard, about him going to see Mitterrand and how in that one meeting that made such a difference?
Oh, yeah. Well, look, these are two hugely important. Bob and Bono are hugely important figures in my life. I remember when I was taking time off to do Make Poverty History, I said to Bono, I'm going to take off a whole year. And he just looked at me and said, only a year? thinking how unfair that was. Yeah, you know, Bob, that was one of the reasons that I do all the stuff I now do with the UN and stuff, is because Bob said, you know, you get money from people, and that's brilliant because it changes individual lives. But if you want structural change, go to government. And he said he had a cup of tea, not a very good cup of tea, apparently, with Peter on. And he made more money in 40 minutes than he had done from Band-Aid and Live Aid.
Which is incredible. And the Make Poverty History, obviously, it focuses on issues and the Millennium and Development Goals. But something like that is so big. Do you ever think when you took that on, you think, how can you as one person make such a big difference?
I don't know. I mean, I've just tried to use my, you know, my very minor communication skills. And sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes, you know, governments do brilliant things and they communicate it so badly. You know, they don't grasp how important and how interesting it is. And so I'm a great believer in people. You know, that's why I think something like what's happening on Friday is so great, because you get people who are funny, who are great at communication, who entertain people, who are popular, actually allowing people to access really dark issues and really tough things in people's lives. So what I try and do with the UN, and I mean, we know we came up with the name Make Poverty History instead of the Alliance to, you know, make constitutional and structural changes which will eventually create less poverty, as it were. You know, so I see myself as just a kind of lubricant towards making things better. And that's what Comic Relief has always been. Just a really juicy, perky way of trying to make sure that you can actually, you know, get amongst the hard stuff.
And as we look forward to this coming Friday night, your entire comedy writing, did it start on Blackadder? Was that your first huge success, Richard?
Actually, I did something called Not the 9 o'clock News.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That.
Yeah.
That was my first thing. Yeah, I started working with Roman. It is quite funny. It's quite funny thinking about Frank. I was just looking at the list of everyone who's appearing and thinking how many of these people are friends of mine. Never. Chris O'Dowd's doing it, isn't
yes.
he? And then
yeah.
Saoirse's doing it. Saoirse's doing a sort of special appearance. Dara O'Brien is in it. And we once did our best to kill him on a Sport Relief challenge, I remember, where he very nearly drowned. We failed. Aisling B's in it.
Yeah.
I now started to think that, and then of course I made that film with Donald Gleeson. So I now realise that my entire career has been on the shoulders of Irish talent.
Have you got your own favourite moments? Like, we're talking about Friday and the Normal People. Obviously, that 7-minute clip in particular is going to be loved by everyone. Do you have, as we come to the end of our interview, a favourite Comic Relief moment or not?
You know, I've got a few of them. So when Sacha Baron Cohen talked to the Beckhams, that was pretty great.
Mm.
And I remember him refusing to meet them beforehand because he knew he was going to hurt their feelings later. I love the Peter Kay Amarillo thing just because it's an explosion of joy. And then I love that moment when Lenny Henry says, forget geography. You know, if somebody came and knocked on your door and said, I'm in real trouble, give me a fiver. You'd give them a fiver. You'd give them 10 quid. And that's the thing about Friday. You know, you've got people who, under such pressure, you know, in terms of, you know, mental health and even food poverty, And basically, this show's just knocking on your door and saying, can you spare a fiver? And it's, I hope, going to be a really funny night, but also a great opportunity to just reach out and make an unexpectedly large shift in someone else's life.
And final question, Richard, for people listening who will be watching on Friday night, tell them why it matters. Like, you've been doing it since 1985. It can change people's lives, can't it, if you give some money?
Do you know, it absolutely can. I mean, let's just say, you know, if you think about something like domestic violence, you've got someone living in fear of their partner. And what actually happens is you man a helpline or you help, you know, a refuge where that person can go. That absolutely will save their life and save the life of their children. You've got people, and then instantly that day, you've got someone who's hungry, who's got nothing to do, who's in real trouble with regard to food, and they're choosing between money for medicine and money for food. Suddenly, you know, their problems are over. So it helps in the long term, but it helps in the short term. It's just a way to be a brilliant neighbour.
Well, look, Richard Curtis, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us this morning. Of course, RT Does Comic Relief is going out this coming Friday night live from 8 p.m. So make sure you all tune in. Happy Father's Day to everybody, including you, Richard, on Saturday.
Oh, I remember.
On sound to Jamie Doyle. Thank you. Thanks to Shanna Gorman. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll be here at the time this time next Sunday. Until then, Sloan.